Well, hello there. Oh, I've got lots of letters for Santa today. And every year, they're the same. Some ask for toys, but a lot ask questions.
A yo-yo? She wished to give me a present?
I'd like to be a dentist.
Hello, everyone, and welcome again to the Christmas Specials We Love podcast. We're getting into the most watched Christmas special of all time, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Kevin, Elaine, Kelsey, Ann, and Rick, all here from all of our different generations to break this down. This is definitely not an open and shut one, Rick and Ann, in terms of the responses the younger generations have to this.
True.
Excited to hear.
Yeah, I can remember Kevin back in the late 90s when we headed west. We talked about this on the ride. So excited for this one.
Oh, my gosh. We broke
it. It was great because Rick always, I love Rick on the show. Rick always just had a way of just knocking the lid off the trash can, or and I would say just giving you the punch to the groin where you'd be like, no, this is exactly the subtext. I'm like, wait, what? But okay, fascinated to get into this now. Ann, you growing up, this was a favorite of yours or not?
I mean, definitely an early favorite, Kev. Again, going back to the special was on once a year. Family all got together, gathered around. You maybe got the bowl of Doritos or pretzels, which were a rare treat back in the day.
Or, by the way, or the popped popcorn is even.
Oh, yeah, the popcorn. The popcorn.
The popcorn. Yeah, because that was cheaper.
Cheaper. Once my dad went with the air popper, though, we were all a little bit on the protest of the popcorn.
Yeah, that was new gen. Yeah, no, I got that. It was on the pan, Rick, with the oil. Rick, were you guys rich and spoiled enough to get Jiffy Pop? We
once
didn't
in a while. Yeah, really. And then you got to eat the burnt kernels at the end.
You were
at the bottom of the tray. It was awful.
So you can see Kelsey's face is so confused. I know Elaine didn't come to this country until she was 13, so she probably at least has a better appreciation. Kelsey and Elaine, did you go ahead?
No, ahead.
Finish it.
No, I was just going to say, always one of my favorites. You know, plus it was the full hour. On a side personal note, don't judge this, but Yukon Cornelius, my first true love.
Okay, I liked it. By the way, he really was, looking back at this, the unsung hero of this. But anyway, I digress.
And a hipster.
I already digressed, I think, Kev.
And a hipster. Okay, Rick, you're digressing as well. Kelsey and Elaine, just general thoughts.
Of the movie?
Yes, the special. We like to call it a special.
A special. I didn't like it. Sorry.
I didn't either. It was
wow. Breathe, Kevin.
Ouch.
It was even hard for me to like finish strong with watching. I was like, everyone's mean. Didn't make me feel warm and fuzzy at all. Everyone just hated on Rudolph, and then they used him at the end, and I was like, screw you guys.
It just made me mad. I was like, this is not a very Christmassy feeling that I want to be feeling. I was just angry.
Me too.
We didn't look at it as them being mad at all in the day. That was how it was.
It's how it was, but that's why I ask, as you burn us all at the stake, can you please have some empathy that this is how we grew up? That's how we were taught how life was. And I like to say the Catholic way of producing. Rick and Ann, but you know, maybe I'm a little off on that, but that was kind of life anyway. All right, so listen, there's be more in our discussion. Rick, you seem like you have something to say before we get into production history and notes.
No, that's okay. It'll sit because I was just gonna say, you mentioned the Catholic way of doing things. This reminds me of how the Japanese saying of the nail that sticks up gets hammered down, you know, and that's the philosophy of the special. Because it is. Back in our day, when we were kids, you had to conform. It was more important to be part of the group than to be an individual. And I think that's really shifted. So these guys probably have a big... sorry?
My counterpoint, though, Rick, if we go by that phrase, a nail sticking up on a board, it's not a good thing. I'm going to cut my foot. the floorboard's going to fall out. There's a million, like, nothing good comes out of a nail. It needs, that nail needs to be hammered down.
But no, you're looking at it from the board's perspective, well, not the nails. The nail's trying to be itself.
Because the nails got right.
You're looking at it from the Catholic perspective, somebody, as opposed to Japanese philosophy.
Okay. All right, guys, listen. Let's Anne has gone to a lot of work to prepare. I'll behave, everyone. We'll have time to break down the scenes. And at the very end, we will go over the controversy around the alleged bullying, misogyny, racism, and all the other things that people have found in this 50-minute special. But Anne, I will give you the flower.
Sounds good, say. Kev. Thanks. Robert L. May created Rudolph in 1939 as an assignment for Montgomery Ward. Montgomery Ward used to buy and give away coloring books for Christmas until in 1939, when they decided to make a book of their own in order to save money.
Of course, always the money.
Those department stores always looking to clip you somewhere, right? That's when Robert L. May created Rudolph. He considered naming the reindeer Rollo or Reginald before deciding upon using the Rudolph, and based the character on the fact that his daughter really liked reindeer. May was staring out his office
Rollo,
window.
Rollo, what's up, player? Imagine if he was Rollo.
I know.
No, but it leaves room for an alternative. All right, right. Elaine, write that down, please.
I think we'd like to bring back his cousin, Rollo, and maybe Reginald.
That's what I'm saying. I think we got Rollo and Reggie. Yeah, because they were left behind. They didn't get the fame that Rudolph got. Oh, I digress again. Elaine, you write that down. Please.
I like it, Kev.
We will produce our own. Okay.
Will they have the family trait of the red nose?
And we're getting ahead of ourselves. We don't want to give this away. We don't want to give it. Someone's going to steal this idea.
Let's go back to our buddy Robert L. May as he was reflecting and staring out his window in downtown Chicago. And he saw fog that was blocking his view. That's when the idea came to him of the bright red nose to lead the way.
Nice.
Now, you got to remember, in the 1930s, a bright red nose was associated with alcoholics and drunkards. So the story idea was initially rejected till he got an illustrator.
Rummy.
Right. And he's like, W.C. Fields. Rejected until he got the illustrator to draw a cute reindeer, getting the store to get on board.
Nice.
2.4 million copies sold that first year.
Wow.
Astonishing. Keep in mind, this story is, it's short, it's basic, and it's not much like the Rankin Bass special.
You know, and it's actually a poem, and Rick, you're a writer, so there was a description of the type of poem, very similar to the Twas the Night Before Christmas. I couldn't even pronounce the description, sorry. But anyway, it was written more in poetry form, the actual book.
Nice.
That's what I had read.
Gotcha.
Nice. The books lead to a cartoon theatrical short that's produced in 1948 by Popeye's illustrator, Max Fleischer.
I love him.
He's great. The story is the most loyal to the book, then the Rankin-Bass Rudolph, and even the song. Oh. Keep in mind, at this point, there's still no Rudolph song. If you hear this song in the old short today, it's only because they added it years later, after the song came out.
So I actually went and I watched this short. Rick, has anyone ever seen this cartoon?
No.
Okay.
No.
So, 1948, this is well before the Rankin Bass one. It's very slow, kind of boring, but the story is something to the effect of he's made fun of by one other reindeer for his nose. He goes to bed Christmas Eve, hoping to get presents from Santa, and you cut to Santa, who's trying to get to deliver presents, but it's really snowing out, so he's got to fly low. He's having a hard time. He arrives at Rudolph's bed to give him presents. He sees his nose glows. He invites him to come lead the sleigh. He leads the sleigh, and then I think it's Christmas Day. Everyone is invited to gather in the center of the town, and it's Santa calls Rudolph, I think, Citizen of the Year or something. He gets some kind of award from Santa. Everyone cheers, and that's pretty much the end of it. That's
seems a little less controversial than the Rankin Bass one that we're discussing here today.
Yes, a little more simple, and yeah. But I'd say it's a pass. I don't think you need to watch it. Sorry.
Okay, good enough. Thanks, Kev. Well, a year later, May's brother-in-law, Johnny Marks, adapted the story of Rudolph into that song, which Gene Autry records. And the song goes on to be number one. And believe it or not, remained the second best-selling record of all time until the 1980s.
Nice.
Now, this is the first of many holiday specials produced by Arthur Rankin and Jules Bass.
So you cut to 1964, right?
Yes.
So from 49, there's basically Rudolph is, you know, it exists in this cartoon and in this book that gets published, right? And but then it's not until 64 that Rankin Bass does theirs.
Sorry, yes. Thanks for bringing me back there, Kevin, and announcing the year. And what was great about this and revolutionary, it was a stop motion animated TV special, the first one.
The first one that Rankin and Bass would do.
Yeah. Arthur Rankin
Let me say this thing is, I don't want to screw anyone up. It was their first holiday special because they did a Wizard of Oz.
Right.
And they were commercial directors, because I went deep on these guys and I think there's a whole other special just in them. Mm-hmm. But I know that this is their first Christmas holiday special.
Yes. I agree with that, and I think we should do a spinoff on the Rankin Bass. And you and I had talked, I think that'd be great and very interesting too.
Yeah, I think so.
All right. So, like Kev just said, the first of many holiday specials produced by Rankin and Bass. Rankin was actually neighbors with Johnny Marks, who wrote the Rudolph song, and he approached him for the rights. He had to coax him, as Marks feared the special would in some way hurt the sales of the song.
How hilarious is that? I mean, it's such an artist mentality. Oh, no. You know, but isn't it funny? Like, proximity is everything in business. It is. You know, I know the low way of saying it is it's all who you know. But in business, proximity is so important. And, like, think of how this all happens. It was May writes the book. The brother-in-law then creates a song. And then the next-door neighbor says, hey, let's make a cartoon about it.
Right. You know? And even a sign of the times there, Kev, like do you even know what your neighbors are doing right now? Like back then he knew his neighbor was writing a song about a reindeer.
Yeah. I would say in Hollywood neighborhood, speaking of someone who lives in one, you would know the writer of Rudolph. You would know. Yeah. It only speaks to the fact that they were probably in an upper middle-class neighborhood of some kind where they actually did know. At least in our business, I think, yeah, we all know.
Okay.
Yeah, I wonder if they were minor celebrities just because of it, you know?
Probably, yeah.
Good thoughts, Rick. Well, Rankin and Bass are now synonymous with claymation puppets and stop-motion animation, which is a technique called Animagic.
Yeah, that they actually named it Animagic, which is really cool, which I should have looked and see if they even trademarked that, but they created that effect of, you know, animating the puppets and figures, and but then also adding another form of animation over it. Like sometimes you see the snow coming down, but it looks more like a cartoon, but it's that cartoon in front of the puppets, you know, behind them is an actual set with the little puppets.
Yeah. They actually outsourced most of the actual animation to companies and animators in Japan.
Yeah. And they were basically one of the first to do that. Now it's you know, staple, but they were one of the first that went out to a Japanese company. And Rick, you and I did a little stop motion animation back in the day.
Yeah.
It's basically, for anyone who doesn't know, I mean, you basically move, let's say, one of these stick figures or one of these puppets, you'll move them, say, you know, a little fraction, and then you'll take a photo of it. Then you'll move them another fraction and take another photo. So it is a very, very long process just to get them to take one step, let alone do all things. And the way that it's so smooth shows just how many of those actions that I just described that they must have done.
It's done.
Yeah, 24 a second, right? 24 frames a second. Isn't that kind of the standard?
Yes. Yeah.
So that's crazy.
Shoot me.
I know. I have way too much ADD for that. I never would be able to do that. As far as the story behind the special goes, though, the screenwriter Romeo Muller introduced several new characters inspired by the song's lyrics.
Yeah, and characters outside the song, like Abominable Snowman, and like this Muller guy, to me, because I'm Rick, you know, you're a writer, Rick, I'm a writer, but I just, to me, he I give him so much credibility because, or credit, because he, you know, he's the one who took this song and then makes the story. But then also a lot of the great Rankin Bass specials, he's the story man behind them all. And to me, I know it takes a village. You've got great music. You've got the great look. But the stories, I thought, and the characters were just wonderful. And this was the guy that was the architect behind them.
Yeah, brilliant. Mueller told an interviewer shortly before his death that he would have preferred to base the teleplay on May's original book, but he could not find a copy.
Thank God.
I know, right? Things do sometimes happen for a reason.
Yeah.
Mueller would write all the Rankin Bass gems and was known to love People, Life, and Christmas. Now, unlike him who loved People, Life, and Christmas, there was a little bit of controversy and disdain with Larry Romer, the director. He caused quite a bit of drama, even though he received screen credit for directing. According to Bill Giles, he didn't do much work. And everybody who was working with him was always being put down, thinking they were doing everything wrong. And that's when Rankin took over as kind of the makeshift director. And Rankin and Romer's relationship continued to deteriorate until Rankin took over completely.
That makes sense because these things have such fingerprints on them. It makes sense that it was some, you always have to have one person's strongest vision. It's like when you bring in different directors for one, like look at Star Wars or some other pieces of intellectual property out there. Different directors have different looks, different interpretations. So it makes sense that someone was a unified driving force because these ones that were shot in the 60s and into the mid 70s definitely were all had the same kind of look and feel.
Yeah.
That makes sense.
Yep, it does. Thanks for that, Kev.
Sorry, Ian. Do you guys know how that process would work? Like, would the Japanese animators send select reels and then the director would direct off of that, or would he be with the animators?
I think, Rick, the directing is probably with the actors.
So the voice actors.
Yeah, because I think they have storyboards. And so I don't know, maybe the director worked with to create the storyboards, which, you know, storyboards an actual, I don't know, for better, a sketch or a cartoon image of what each frame will look like. And then with descriptions underneath, they would send that to Japan. I think Japan would do it. But then when it would come back, probably from there, your creative work would be in directing the actors. But I had even, and then obviously you'd oversee the music, the editing, your story. You know, there'd be a lot that you're kind of the, I don't know, the head coach, let's say, where you might have a special teams coach, an offensive lineman coach, but you're going to be the one that makes the final call on that stuff. And I bet you it was Rankin. It makes sense.
Yeah. Mm. Wow. Good question. We might have to cover that in the Rankin Bass special that we do. The success of Rudolph obviously led to numerous other holiday specials, Little Drummer Boy, Frosty the Snowman, Santa Claus Has Come to Town, The Year Without a Santa Claus. Other holidays were also covered. The Easter Bunny Has Come to Town and several other Rudolph offshoots. We're hoping to cover all of, you know, most of those here.
Some of them, I know most of them. I just, there's a couple of the Rudolph ones that came out later. Rick, did you see Rudolph and Frosty?
Yeah, Rudolph's Shiny New Year. Yeah, I remember seeing that as a kid and rejecting it out of hand.
And being kind of
first viewing. Yeah.
All right.
Same, Rick.
This isn't Rudolph.
All right, we'll get there.
Agreed. I hated Baby New Year, but I digress, Kev. Yes. I digress. This Rudolph, however, is the longest running Christmas special of all time. Sorry, Elaine and Kels on that.
Yeah.
Other than Burl Ives, who plays Sam the Snowman and narrator, all the characters were portrayed by Canadian actors. Most of which were also Jewish.
Shout out Canada.
Really? You know what else about them? Wow. I'll help from here, Ian, if you don't mind.
No, not at all.
I was doing some research. I was curious, why would they go with Canadian actors? Well, I think the cynical side of me says they were cheaper. They only had to pay him $1,000 a year in residuals for the only 3 years after shooting, plus probably at a far reduced rate. But we were, radio in our country by the 60s was getting away from the, you know, from doing dramas on radio where actors would read lines and they would do radio plays, but Canada was still into it. So they had a far deeper talent base to work with. So that was it. And then with, I guess, all the way up almost to the end of thinking this was going to happen, they didn't have Burl Ives on board. And if you know Burl Ives was a famous movie star and singer. particularly known for his movies. But NBC and the sponsor GE said, you guys got to get us a star if we're going to sell this. So in comes him, but he cuts out the sweetheart deal of sweetheart deals because he gets full residuals. He sings songs. As soon as this is over, he goes and releases his own songs, his own versions of these songs. And he had said, I know in interviews that I think there was one giant vacation lake property he had, an estate of some kind. He was like, yeah, Rudolph paid for all this. Wow. And by the way, one time we had the actress Barbara Eden on my wife's show. She wrote about this in her book. She said that she made a movie with Burl Ives and he just hit on her the whole time. I guess, yeah. He was. I see Rick just nodding his head. He was, yeah, he was.
Well, of course he did.
Yeah, he was a bit of
no shock.
So Sam the Snowman, maybe I'd like to think in my mind, maybe by then, but it was 1964. So she probably made the movie with him in the late 50s or early 60s. So he was in his Sam the Snowman prime. Wow. Okay, I digress. Oh, so you mentioned Larry Mann, who plays, you mentioned Yukon Cornelius was your favorite Anne, right?
Well, he was my first true love.
He's your first true love. All right, I want to hear more about that. But he recorded all of the songs you hear Burl Ives sing. He actually recorded them at first. And then when they got Burl Ives, he got kicked to the curb. And as far as the soundtrack for the special goes, if we can get on the soundtrack, Johnny Marks, who wrote the Rudolph song, also went on to write a lot of other songs on the soundtrack. And he worked close with another great guy, Murray Laws. So you see Murray Laws on a lot of these specials. He was the musical director. And the two just worked hand in hand. So Marks would create the songs, but then the incidental music, the background music, where to place it was Murray Laws. And other than releasing Holly Jolly Christmas, none of these other songs were ever released. And so like today, just know that that would have been an album. I mean, they would have released it, I'm sure, as an album.
The whole
as
thing, singles. I think.
Yeah.
One other cool note, Kev, since we're speaking on the music portion, the woman, well, she was a child, Janice Orenstein, who voiced Clarice. She was only 15 at the time that this was recorded. And she did that, There's Always Tomorrow, in one take.
Wow.
One take. Yeah. And after Rudolph, she actually left acting and went to Germany and went on to become an opera singer. But pretty cool for a 15-year-old.
Is she still with us, Anne?
No, she's not. I don't remember what year she died, but she is. I think the whole cast is gone.
I know you looked, right, the whole cast. I was going to ask you because I know you looked into it. Some of them were bitter because they didn't get any residuals and only around the end of their life, they started to kind of at least embrace the positive of it, of the story getting out there. It's funny. Frank Capra will do It's a Wonderful Life. And he certainly made a lot of money in his career, but he lost a lot of money on It's a Wonderful Life. But at least at the end of his lifetime, he got to see it become so popular. And he was always so happy that even though it cost him a lot of money in the end, he was just happy that the message got out, which I think is cool. And so I do like to think with artists, you got to kind of take it a little better that I would rather see something with a great message go on as long as this has, then to have a few bucks in my pocket. But I know everyone's different.
Yeah.
Anything else, Anne? I think we have.
Yeah, we have a couple of the things that are definitely noteworthy. In the original production, Rankin and Bass didn't want to disclose, and we're kind of on voices now, that the voice of Rudolph was a woman. So Billie Mae Richards, who is the actress, is credited as Billie Richards.
Oh.
That would never fly today. There are many versions of the special, so maybe Kelsey and Elaine, you didn't see the right one. But in the original 1964 version, this special ends with the credit sequence of an elf passing out toys. But fans wrote NBC and GE, General Electric, upset over the plight of the misfit toys and the fact that Santa didn't keep his promise.
Well, not surprised with this Santa not keeping his promise, but
right.
But then what happens next, Dan?
Well, in the rarest fashion, the network heads, this was, I mean, unbelievable. The network heads call for a reshoot where Rudolph and Santa return to the island of the misfit toys.
So, you know what? This is really amazing because this does not happen.
Right.
Ever. It usually suits just it's all about the dollar. No one wants to go backwards. It's all about going forward. And I did read an interview, I think, with this. Somebody had said that whoever was calling the shots, I think, at NBC or GE was really upset over the fact that for the misfit toys.
Yeah.
Like, we got to fix this. We have to go. Let's, you know. And so they pay for a reshoot and they go and do it where, as you know, now Santa goes back and he saves and Rudolph goes back and then all the misfit toys get homes. But it's very rare in our business today. I mean, I think of even Revenge of the Nerds. When I see Kelsey and Elaine's reaction to Rudolph, I see her generation react that way to Revenge of the Nerds, because you have a scene that today is date rape. I mean, basically between one of the nerds and the jock's girlfriend, you know, he poses as the jock and ends up having sex with her and they fall in love. Crazy enough, but it's your reaction, Kelsey and Elaine, was the same as like Roxy and some other of the younger hosts I've worked with. They couldn't see any of the comedy in the movie. They couldn't see any of the redemption, none of the story arcs, nothing. They just saw that one moment and were out. And it's like, and you know, the network heads wouldn't take the time to fix that. You know, go edit it out, find a way.
Right.
So the movie could be preserved, because it's a really good movie. You know, it's like, but it literally takes down the whole movie. So I'm just saying, I just think it was great that these guys did this. And I wish more studios would do this to preserve certain pieces of art rather than see them be, you know, cast off.
So. Yeah. I mean, if it's done in a timely fashion, Kev, I agree with that, because if we did it, you know, based on new generations and new levels of standard, all of our classic movies would have different.
Yeah. Right. I guess I'm talking about the ones that really, though, it drastically affects them.
Yeah. Story.
Right. Certainly if it's a masterpiece, you know, I don't want to see any of that stuff touched, but if it's going to be shelved, or it's, you know, something's missing where it's not going to have the impact, then no, I'm all for this. And by the way, like, listen, note to studios, you can make more money this way, because you have the original and then you've got the director's cut, and then you have, like, you can call it the new director's cut, new producer's cut. There's always a way to package it. I know that also the Yukon and the peppermint mine at the end, I don't know if in your versions, Yukon Cornelius, he throws up his pickaxe and he licks peppermint and he goes, I discovered a peppermint mine. So Kelsey's nodding. She saw that. Rick, you didn't see that in your version.
No.
Okay. So Rick, that was in the original 64 version, but to make room now for Santa to rescue the toys, they cut it.
Oh, okay.
They also cut the song "We're a Couple of Misfits" and instead inserted a new song called "Fame and Fortune." Fame and Fortune.
Right.
And although the creators were obviously fine and going along, they got paid, they did it, they all were sad because they thought the Misfit song was more organic and was better. But again, the power of the fan base is behind this. So many, as Anne was saying, there's like five or six different versions that come out over the years until finally now we have a version that has everything in it. Yep. So they've brought it back. Now, certain networks only show certain versions, but there are versions out there. Like the one that I saw had it all in there. Actually had everything, but I will say this. It had everything in there but Fame and Fortune. I did not see that in my version. So I know there's other controversies involved too, which we'll get into the deeper ones in our post-wrap-up after scene breakdowns. But Hermie the Elf, his name is Hermie, not Herbie, as a lot of people think. And you know what I kind of figured out in watching it back? I swear one of the actors who plays one of the elves, the lesser known, the one of the elves that just has a line or two, does say Herbie. And I think that's how it got started.
Thing.
Yes. I think that's where it came from. He did lack pointed ears, the character of Hermie. People thought, like, is that why he's a misfit too? And the creator's like, no, we just wanted him to look like a little boy to be more relatable. Now, there's a guy out there by the name of Rick Goldschmidt. I got to give him credit because he claims, and I think rightfully so, that all this information we're talking about that now is available second and third hand, he's the one that dug it up. So this was the guy that hunted down Rankin and Bass, went to them and was like, somewhere in the 90s, was like, you're sitting on these masterpieces. Please, we have to tell your story. And he wouldn't leave them alone. And they had moved on. They were very old school and not as sentimental like our generations are. It seemed like they were like, you know, we did our job, made our money. Now we're moving on to the next thing. Not that they didn't love it and put their hearts into it, but they didn't realize that they were the Walt Disneys of this world, but he did, and cornered them and was relentless. And then finally they gave in, let him write a book. So he's like known as the number one journalist / biographer of this, but this is just to show you how passionate is Rick. You'll get a kick out of this. This is one quote from him. One thing I should make clear is that the elf who wants to be a dentist is named Hermie. Why everyone is calling him Herbie, I will never fully understand. Maybe one day someone will correct the error, because it's simply not right to change a character's name that has become a television icon.
I mean, come on, seriously.
He's not playing.
Yeah,
he's not joking around.
And I, by the way, love the madness. Love it all. send this guy, I just, you know, back him up a Brinks truck. I love it. But anyway, no, now he goes and he lectures. He speaks at different cons around the world. His book, I actually have it, but it's $70 or $80 a book. But I mean, the amount of research and detail in these books are incredible. So shout out to Rick Goldsman. Okay. So the other big controversy is the doll on the Island of Misfit Toys, Dolly, is everyone's like, why is she a misfit? And people are like, maybe because she doesn't have a nose. Like, why is she a misfit? Well, in 2000, during an interview with the Television Academy, Arthur Rankin revealed that she is a standout of the rest of the cast because she was just a last minute addition. but now wait, no, Rick, come on now. But in December 28th of 2007, during Wait, Don't Tell Me, the mystery was revealed as Rankin admitted she was cast off by her mistress and was clinically depressed. She felt abandoned, a backstory similar to Toy Story. So I don't know if they came up with that as a save, but there you go, Kelsey and Lane. You can relate to that. Anxiety, depression, right? Absolutely. That would make her a misfit.
That's our girl.
She was invalidated.
Well, now I'm going to make her a misfit because everyone feels that way.
That's right. Back then, she was a misfit. No, today she would be popular. There's also controversy, as we said, around allegations of condoning bullying, misogyny, and even gay bashing. But let's get into that after our breakdown. One more note about the actual figures, the puppet figures. No one at the time knew that this was going to be a special that would be watched over and over again. So no one really saw the value of the puppets. In 2007, Rankin claimed to have an original Rudolph figure, but no one else really knew where they were until it was discovered that a secretary took them, discarded seven of them. And I remember hearing a story where she just left them up in her attic and they just kind of wilted and melted, you know, but they were up there. And because of all the activity and the excitement, it somehow gets out that she's got them. And they end up on two of them end up on the Antique Roadshow on PBS in 2005. And they sell for $8,000 to $10,000, which, you know, is again very short money. But a guy by the name of Kevin Chris, who is another madman in the best way, he buys them and takes them to an LA-based puppet company to restore them. And then he restores them. And in 2020, just a couple of years ago, he sells them for $368,000.
Wow. That's a big difference.
Right. And then that same year, and this is why I just think sometimes museums and people are cool. I don't have more information than that. Other than this, they were then donated to the Center for Puppetry Arts in Atlanta, Georgia. Because I always think like, okay, fine, make your money. But these things, rather than end up in someone's living room or even worse, I have some artifacts that are in a vault. I mean, not even my home vault. They're in a safety deposit box somewhere in the world. Mm. And right now it's an asset that I want to have for my children. But it is nice when these things can be seen. So I really give credit to the people who eventually go, you know what, museum. Arthur Rankin Jr., who was 11 years older than Bass, he passes away at 89, at the age of 89 in 2014. But Jules Bass just died, you guys, in October last month, October 25th.
Oh, wow.
He just passed. He was at an assisted living home. You know, God, the comedian Mario, God, gay comedian. He's actually from the Boston area, Rick.
Cantone?
Yes. So Mario Cantone is more obsessed with these specials than we are. And he got to know Bass to a degree and would stalk him all the time and tell him, you're the Walt Disney of this. Why don't you do more? And, you know, he was always kind of waved it off. But interesting that he was still with us all these years later, still with us. So with that, kids.
Kevin, can I ask a quick question before we move on? Just what do you guys think about the stop action puppetry? Do you like it? Did you like it as a kid? Like today it would just be animated, right? It would be drawings that
Animated. they've done newer versions of it with the Miser Brothers, with the Year Without a Santa Claus. They've done reboots in 2000s and they're just too slick and too smooth. I don't know. They don't have the same feel, but I think it's a question for Kelsey and Elaine, because to me, I love it. But if I look at the 1920s Popeye cartoons, they're masterpieces. They are the animation's incredible, but I'd like to ask Kelsey and Elaine, forget the content of the creative content of the story. What did you think of the aesthetic?
I liked it. It doesn't bother me. To me, it's just like this is an older movie. So I think it's kind of cool. It's nice to, the difference is nice compared to what we see now. But yeah, I thought it was nice.
I just give a lot of respect that it's a stop motion, you know, type of movie. And it's like so incredibly long. and you have to move it tiny.
Yeah, the process is long. Yeah, no, it is. It's
so long, like you were saying, like 24 frames per second. So you have 24 tiny little movements to film 1 second. So it's just insane, and I pay a lot of respect to them for that.
But Rick, you're a filmmaker, so now I want to hear from you. And you had to watch all these cartoons with your children growing up over the last few years. So yeah. I'm sure you see the differences. So tell us what you think. Well,
Ian, you go first.
I think at the time I was a big Davy and Goliath fan, and all of the stop motion were great.
But that was choppy compared to this. Davy and Goliath was choppy compared to this.
It was very choppy, but yeah. I loved it all. And all of my favorite specials, Rudolph, Year Without a Santa Claus, Santa Claus Has Come to Town, is this same style. So those were my favorite things as a kid. So I loved them then. Didn't know any better because, like Kev pointed out in one of our other shows, what did we have to compare it to? Hanna-Barbera of the Flintstones. So that was super basic. And
you're
now,
lucky you have this. Believe me, we had nothing when we were young. That's what we heard from our parents. Probably a quote from my mother.
My dad could have said the same thing. Yeah, so the nostalgia of it now is just like, you look at it and you see like it's a little choppy and what have you, but I still love it for what it is. And now I respect it for, again, the work that had to go into it. So
I'm a little different. I have to say, I'm surprised that Kelsey and Elaine can appreciate it. Cause to me, I kind of saw the flaws when I was a kid and I see them even more now. Cause I compared it to like Warner Brothers cartoons, Bugs Bunny, you know, those early and Elmer Fudd, which were also masterpieces in Popeye. They so were, to me, remember those were more powerful.
They are, but they're also animation, or claymation.
I guess I couldn't appreciate the claymation as much. And I did not love Davy and Goliath. I didn't like Kukla, Fran and Ollie puppet shows. No, I kind of had an adverse reaction to it, to be honest with you.
Can I tell you why Goliath worked? Yeah. Why it worked for me? It was the subutext to the heroine of my Saturday morning cartoons. Remember, it came on a Sunday. You had no cartoons. You had all boring stuff on. You were at your grandparents. And then all you had was Davy and Goliath. So we had to go with what we had, Rick. And there were some powerful episodes when the grandmother died. I'll never forget that one.
That was my favorite. The Easter episode.
Yeah. See, Rick,
I didn't appreciate stop motion until you got to Mr. Bill on Saturday Night Live. Then I started to like it again, which is,
I think for me with Davy and Goliath, I was only allowed 2 hours of pre-approved programming a week of regular TV, but Davy and Goliath along with Captain Bob were freebies. So my Sunday morning, I got to watch that.
Shout out to Captain Bob.
Yeah, he was great.
Captain Bob, he was a cartoonist. He did the drawing, but he did
crayons.
You drew along with him. Not to be taken away from the other guy with the Bob Ross, who got totally screwed, right? Like in the I don't even know if his documentary came out about his life. But you remember Bob Ross on PBS, Rick?
Oh yeah.
Of course.
We are really digressing.
Oh, let's Bob Ross. My generation seems to really love Bob Ross. They'll just watch his videos.
Yeah,
on
we
YouTube,
know Bob Ross.
Have a day in and just paint with them.
Captain Bob was similar, and it wasn't cartoon though. He actually drew, animals, fish and eagles and all sorts of things from wildlife. But it was well done, and he taught kids how to draw. So it was a great show.
And then you sent in your work, and he showed it on TV.
Except he never showed ours in, did he?
Mine was never shown. Always submitted, never
neither.
Shown.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Okay. That's okay. As my mother would say, that's all right. No, that's all right. Everyone laugh. Good.
My mom would say, well, Ann, I don't think that's where your talent lies.
Oh my God.
Love it. It was a different world, children.
Ann, I don't think that's where your talent lies.
We digress.
We digress.
Even on the holidays, we digress. Yeah. So Rick, I see some of the flaws, but I guess it doesn't, I don't know why. I'm such a fanboy. I don't know. It's part of the charm.
No, it strikes people different ways, definitely. There are certain scenes, we'll get to it, but like when you see the Bumble's foot drop in when Rudolph is with his dad, Donner, and they hide behind the snowbank. I remember being petrified at that scene when I was little. So there are certain instances where I think it's much better and has a greater impact. But yeah, just overall, it didn't strike me, I think, the same way it struck you.
Yeah, I think, and for me, that's the question of whether we'd want to see these animated or done with animagic. I 100% think animagic. I don't think they have the same effect with just cartoon animation, you know. By the way, to the same effect, but who knows? It's the same effect. They make Frosty, which is pure animation. Mm-hmm. And then when they've claymated Frosty, I know the story wasn't as strong, but it wasn't the same effect.
Right.
It wasn't as, to me, it didn't seem as powerful when Frosty went to claymation. So I don't know. Who knows? All right, kids, should we start breaking the scenes down of this thing?
Break them down, Kev.
All right. So we open with old footage of snowstorms and newspapers from the Daily Mail to the San Francisco Chronicle. One headline, Sanitation Army may have to dig us out. What's a sanitation army, Rick?
It's, I think, the old term for snowplow crews.
That's what they called them?
It would fall under the Department of Sanitation, snow removal. So I think that's where it comes from.
Yeah. Is it still their job in times?
No, they've probably been separated into public works now, but same idea. Department of Sanitation, Department of Public Works.
And then the last headline, foul weather may postpone Christmas, which just leads us into Sam the Snowman, which of course, as we mentioned, is Burl Ives. He tells us he's living in the North Pole. He's reminiscing about the year that the world almost missed Christmas due to a huge blizzard. He introduces to Christmas Town that he calls the North Pole, and he shows us the Claus's castle, and it's the first and only castle on the left. And we get a quick glimpse of Mrs. Claus and Santa. By the way, I'll still say I've never seen Santa represented like this, and even as a kid, it was just weird to see him. He's skinny. He's like an Italian immigrant. His accent, I don't know if you noticed, which is strange. Then he's also not very Santa-like for the Santa that we were taught as kids. And even Mrs. Claus, you know, usually you see her in white hair and you see her, she's a little bigger. And this, she's the, again, that's my grandma Lucinda, you know, like she's the Italian grandmother. Eat, but the iconic eat, Papa, eat, you know, to the skinny Santa. And of course, I don't know about you guys, but I've heard that throughout my life. I've always heard that go, eat, Papa, and they're getting it from this.
Yep.
We go back to Sam, and he assures us that we'll have Santa fattened up by the new year. It's always the same every year. And this year, it's that he's telling the story, it's peaceful, but then he mentions it wasn't always that way. And what's interesting with Sam the Snowman, and even some of the claymation characters, the way he shudders and gets nervous, and you see it through, like, they're really able to conjure emotion. It's also Burl Ives, who's just amazing actor, amazing voice. But before I get too far, okay, Kelsalina, did you at least like the snowman and the narrator, or did?
Yeah, he was cute. He kind of reminded me, I don't know if they did this on purpose, but I mean, Elf is my favorite Christmas movie ever, which people probably are rolling their eyes at.
No, but I don't think so. No, it's a generational
thing. Elf.
I don't think so. Elf's great.
Elf's great.
But I feel like he reminded me of the snowman and Elf, so I liked that.
Okay, so can I tell you something about Elf? Right, so Favreau, who's in the Rick, Kevin, and Ann camp, John Favreau, the director, when he went to do Elf, he knew, I want to make this evergreen. I want to make this something someone sees every year. And what are the, when I take Coke and make Pepsi, what's the Coca-Cola formula of Christmas specials and movies? It's these things. So if you see some of his production design, you'll see a polka dotted elephant. You'll see all different things that he took from this very special that you don't like, Kelsey and Elaine. And he took that you don't have Elf without this.
Yeah.
And he admits that. Right. He was a huge fan of all this stuff, and he studied it head to toe. And that's why you have
that. I believe that. It's funny because, like, I think the special, I understand why y'all love it. And I think it definitely serves its purpose. But man, I just hated how mean they all were.
We'll get there. We'll get there.
You digress. Back to scene by scene. Yeah.
Scene. Can I ask a question, Kevin? So I always assumed that the snowman was based because they had landed Burl Ives, because I always thought they were inextricably tied, but I guess not. The snowman was written in, and then they just cast Burl?
I guess he was just known as Snowman. And then when they did get Earl, I think Anthony Roberts or Tony Roberts, there's a guy that had the idea to say, let's make the snowman look like Burl Ives.
Okay.
And so he came
and
up
added
with that
like
idea.
The mustache. And
Yeah, okay. That makes sense.
Which is perfect. Cool. Well, he talks about it's always peaceful up there, except for this one year with Rudolph. And that's when he goes into the Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer song. And then we get from him singing, we go to instrumental music and the credits. What I love that Rankin Bass does, and I have used this technique too in some productions we've done. If you notice in the opening, he takes instrumental clips of all the future songs you're going to hear and they play them, you know, in the opening credits.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Yeah. Mm. And you'll see it in a lot of the specials. It's really cool. It just sets a nice tone. And it's a little teaser for what's coming. You see in the credits, writer Romeo Muller, who we mentioned, Robert May, who had the original Rudolph story, and then the song by Johnny Marks. But then Johnny Marks gets a second title card, which is his own. When I say title cards, they're credits, but in the form of gift boxes. Johnny Marks gets one for music and lyrics. Then Burl Ives gets his own card as the narrator, but then he even gets a second one telling us what songs he's going to sing. And I have to think that's partly, I think, GE and NBC trying to appeal to fans. And when I think fans, I'm thinking of parents and grandparents, because at that time would have been fans of Burl Ives, especially grandparents, to hear that his music was being sung. I think that that would have kept them hooked. Because remember, this is playing at 8 o'clock at night,
right?
You know, on a weeknight. So anyway, and then it's obviously part, if I were his agent, I would have been fighting for that to get him a second credit. Jules Bass is a co-producer. Larry Romer, who we mentioned earlier, is the director, though he's a director, not a director. And then we see at the end, produced by Arthur Rankin, who's older. He's the senior party of Rankin Bass. Okay, we get back to Sammy. Introduces us to Donner, the reindeer family, Mrs. Donner, and little baby Rudolph. I thought Rudolph here was just so cute. And I thought it was very clever on the writer's part. The fact that he could already speak, I thought was a little wink at how smart and how special Eddie really was.
Yep. And he recognized Santa. I mean, there were a lot of hints to all of that.
And I think that ends up, you know, Santa does say, and smart too, you know, when he sees him. So I thought that was a nice little thing that writers inserted. But we also see that his nose glows. And of course, the mother says, we'll have to overlook it. And the father is like, I see Rick's eyes closed. He's shaking his head. And the father's like, how can you overlook that? You know, it's, you know, can I say this between Donner and the coach, Comet, who plays the coach later?
Yeah.
That kind of voice, Rick, that was left over from the, you know, this is like the 60s and we're kind of past that in terms of film.
Yeah.
People's actors speak in films, but you notice in films of the 30s, the 20s, 30s, 40s, yeah, 50s, like, sure. Listen, Buster, I'm going to give you a feed you a knuckle sandwich and out the door you're going to go. It was always that kind of. Do you ever notice that? You know, and this is kind of
course.
Kev, you were a little like Tennessee Tuxedo over there. Yep.
Well, you had that. You had WC Fields. That's where that came. Right. That was the same thing, you know?
Yeah.
I'm streetwise. See? Yeah, like New York City.
But then, you know, in comes skinny Santa. And I remember as a kid, this really horrified me. Was when Santa was like horrified by the nose. Like I thought he was going to come in and have compassion and empathy and be like, no, right. Like straighten out the parents. Like, no, it's fine. Like, it's okay. Like, well, and instead he was horrified by the nose. Then he goes and sings, he's the king of ding-a-ling.
Yeah. Why was that necessary? By the way, Rudolph already knew he was Santa, but he has to reintroduce himself.
But he's got to tell them all the scams they're going to pull together, all the missions they're going to accomplish. I think, you know what, John Taffer, when he comes out to Bar Rescue, he used to open up every show. Hello, my name is John Taffer. I've opened over 600 bars. And I say to him, and he was like, Kevin, I have to establish credibility. So I'm thinking Santa was establishing credibility. That's all. He had to get everyone's attention. He had to get Rudolph to fall in line, know who he was. Santa leaves very hopeful that we're going to, you know, we're going to fix this little mess. We're going to cover this up. Donner,
he'll grow up with it. Yeah.
Yeah. And Donner has the great idea that, yes, we'll cover it up. Santa's right. He'll never make the team. Wait, I've got an idea. We'll just cover it up.
Cover it up.
But then you see Rudolph cuddle with the father, and it's such a sweet moment. I, you know, by the way, watching this for me, so Kelson Lane just tap out, but for my generation that's endured this, every aspect of this, I've been the Rudolph, I've been the coach, I've been, you know, throughout my like adult, my adolescence, I was very emotional during all of this. This really, 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 I was more sentimental watching this than even in other years, but I guess because I haven't seen it in a while either.
So you forgave Dad just because he cuddled with him for like...
No, it was just a sweet moment. No, I felt bad.
I was like...
I felt bad for Rudolph.
Oh,
no, you guys just want to cancel and destroy everybody. I'm feeling bad for the little reindeer.
Well, I felt bad for Rudolph too, but I was like, okay, Dad.
But let's kill his parents, cancel him, yep, and then we'll
march.
And while we leave, and while we orphan him, we'll just go and there's more we don't have time to take care of him. We'll just go cancel more people.
Right. And I don't know if this is digressing, but that was more how the dads were back then. You know, they took care of business. They weren't coddlers. So that little moment, like you just said, Kev, was sweet because most dads weren't like, oh, here, honey, come, let me give you a hug.
You know who was a game changer for me? No. Shout out to Mike Brady.
Mike of the Brady. Brady Bunch.
Yes. Oh. Sorry,
big
Rick.
Time.
Because he was he was a disciplinarian, but he had a soft heart. He was, and I was like, I want a dad like that.
He was the gateway dad.
He really was. He was a nice gateway for the first.
Oh, one note there, Kevin. Sorry. Please. So with the cover up scene, did you notice that Rudolph's mother licked it off?
Right.
Which was interesting.
Yeah. Good mom. So, yeah.
And she didn't say a word about it. Just nope. He's going to be the way he is, and licked off the dirt. Which was cool. I like that.
Yeah. So Sam says, for the first year, they cover his nonconformity. Donna teaches Rudolph some of the most important things to do, how to defend himself. And then he also introduces us to the abominable snowman who hates Christmas. Big, scary creature with his fangs and his claws.
But you don't see it then, Kev. You only see his foot and the big
footprint. That's right. You're right. Thank you, Rick. You're right. And that's great filmmaking. Yeah. And you hear...
Yeah,
the noise, you know, the growling. Yeah, very ominous.
And the music, the scary music.
Oh.
Yes.
Yep.
Cut so to the scary. Exterior of the castle, back to Santa's castle. We see animated snow over the animagic. As Sam tells us about all the elves preparing for Christmas Eve, he tells us how toys are made by elves, all except this one misfit elf. So Hermie is singled out by his boss, who in the script is known as Foreman Elf. And Hermie admits, I'm not happy in my work, I guess. He's like, he tries to be honest. I don't like to make toys. And then Hermie doesn't like to make toys. The gossip spreads. And then he even has the courage to admit something. I'd like to be a dentist. He's like, we need one up here, which of course they did. You're an elf and elves make toys. Now get to work. No. And then no break for you. Finish the job or you're fired. That's when he sings the Why Am I Such a Misfit song. And he does say, you can't fire me. I quit.
Right.
Which I liked it. He was taking his power back, but then you see he doesn't quit immediately.
Which was fine. He stuck it out. He knew that was supposed to be his role. He tried to conform.
Sorry, Gen Z millennials. You do have to hang in sometimes for the greater good most of the time. You know, quitting isn't always the option.
That's true, but that elf was mean.
It's so
weird. He was. But again, show me a boss back then that wasn't.
Right.
Oh, gosh, the stories we could tell.
Oh, my God.
He's got a quota.
Crying.
He had a quota. He did.
Rick, he had a quota. Right? Rick is siding with the foreman.
Well, wait a second. No, Rick's not siding with anyone. Empathy for the foreman elf. He had a job. And by the way, I don't know how many millions of kids were depending on him for toys.
Right.
You got to see it. You know, again, it's not black and white millennials and Gen Z. Like you like to see the world. It's gray.
Well, Kev, it's interesting you say that there because I was watching this last night, actually, with my sister, who is a couple years younger than me. And I was like, isn't Santa so mean? And and she agreed the elf foreman was mean. But she was like, I think Santa's just trying to get the job done. I was like, ooh, interesting. She was
tired,
the first one.
Little job burnout. Yeah.
Yeah. Yep. So just interesting, different perspectives.
Now, if I were coaching Santa, though, I'd be the one saying, okay, listen, Santa, you don't get that privilege. You're Santa. There's certain things. Listen, I have a star for a wife. Yeah. Certain things I tell her, you don't get that. You don't get to be tired. You don't get for the position you're in. You can work it out with Mrs. Claus. You can get it out in the inner circle, but out there, no, you got to know better. What do we kids say? Do better, Santa. Is that what we tweet? Tweet out immediately. Yeah. What is it? Know better and do better immediately. Thank you. Let's get that out there.
Thank you.
All right. Hashtag. Back to the Donner family. Donner covers up the nose with a plastic cap. There are more important things than comfort, self-respect. Not wrong, Rick. Wait a second.
Amazing. Like he could control it. You know, that's where I draw the line there, Kev. Self-respect. So you have to hide an aspect of yourself because it's different. That's scary.
For self-respect. Scary.
But it's not self-respect. It's for group approval, right?
Okay.
Got nothing to do with self-respect.
But Donna explains himself. Santa can't object to you now.
You're right. All's forgiven.
It's almost like a pageant mom.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, that's right? A good analogy. So, yeah.
All about the 100%. Judges. Yeah.
Next question, though.
Yeah.
Just like very basic question. Like, what would be wrong with a red nose? No one sees the reindeer. No one sees Santa. Who's he hoping to have this aesthetic for?
Okay, it's an internal problem. You saw how it disrupted the rest of the kids. The rest of the reindeers wanted to make fun of him. It just became a problem. Right? So by the way, morale goes down. And now, you know, next thing we know, it's a red nose, and that's the that's the gateway.
That is the gateway.
The door to how many other things now we have to deal with when we have a job to do. We only have to deliver how many presents to how many ungrateful little brats all over the world in a 24-hour span. You think I have time for somebody to be like, oh, no, I want a blue nose. And by the way, don't even get me started. How many reindeer now are going to ask their parents for an operation to get their nose changed?
Right.
Again, I'm just telling you guys where this.
And then I think it leads to antler changes.
Oh, 100%. Kelsey, by the way, there are sexier antlers. You will admit that, right? And absolutely. There's probably antler augmentation we can do to make improvements.
I think so.
Right? Okay. Yeah. So now I will say this, though. About all joking aside, no, I will say this, that it's not what Dawn is saying is right. And I'll say this from a writer's perspective. They knew it was wrong. And in that moment, Dawn is wrong. He's wrong as a dad. And, you know, and by the way, even at the end, you have even Santa knew. I don't like the term even, but there's a way, you know, at the very end, but it's we're showing real life. We've got a dad that's not accepting this difference. And tell me that that's not something you see.
Probably, all the time.
I'm sure you still see that today. Rudolph sings the Misfit song. And out of all the times the Misfit song sung, he sings it in a more sad way. It seems like he's the sad, maybe because he's the youngest, but seems like out of our three Misfits, Ucorn, Hermy, and him, he seems like he takes it the hardest. I feel like Hermy is a little more resilient.
I think he had so much potential. And then just because of his looks, he was put down. So he's like,
I think he runs away. He's like, I'm just hurting everyone. I don't belong. Whereas Hermie's like, F you, I'm out of here. I'm going to be a dentist.
Right. Yeah. Hermie doesn't give an F. Why do you think that though?
Why does her? I think just the writers wrote it that way. Like they're three friends who all need each other and they all have these, what I think they're showing is that what these quote unquote defects that they seem to all have are actually all their strengths. And if you notice, as we go through the breakdown, these strengths all come to fruition as time goes on. The very thing that they're accused of being misfits for is the very thing that actually makes them superior and helps them to save one another. Sam takes us to April, the month of April, where all the new calves are inspected by Santa. And now Fireball, who's the best friend you don't want to have, but I feel like we all had back in the day, is introduced. Over back at the castle, the Foreman Elf gathers all the elves to sing for Santa. Santa, miserable, doesn't want to be there. But you notice the Foreman Elf's voice is different in this, and I'm surprised in all my research. I swear to God, it sounds like a different actor when the elf addresses Santa. But if it's not, the only creative explanation I have is he cowers around Santa.
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I didn't actually notice that, Kevin, listening or watching it. But
He's no more big shot when Santa's.
Yeah.
Well, you can see the pressure on him. By the way, they say the fish stinks from the head down. And I'm sorry, this Santa, you know, his leadership, his management, I don't know. I'm calling it all into question.
The crap is
rolling downhill. The elves sing We Are Santa's Elves. Mrs. Claus loves it, thinks it's fine. And he's like, needs work, walks out. Now, by the way, I never got that as a kid because I was like, doesn't need any work. Sounds great to me. But Rick, you're the one who's most critical of the production. Surely you must have heard something off key.
I didn't. I just felt it lacked spunk, Kev. I think they could have put a little more effort into it.
Okay, all right.
Little dance moves.
All right.
Yeah, there's no choreography.
We find out it was because Hermie wasn't there. And then the foreman catches Hermie fixing a doll's teeth. And I thought this was so endearing. He was like, I thought I'd find a way to fit in. You know, like I have this skill. Yeah. And okay, if I have to stay, I'll try. You'll never fit in, says the foreman.
Hate him.
Can't can't conform. I guess I'm on my own now. And Hermie makes the wise decision to leave, which I love. Here's what I noticed, though. You know why it's so freaky deaky to Kelsey? Rick, and you're a dad. So today, most dreams are supported by parents. I mean, I will tell you guys, I would say half of my friends' children that I've met have kids going into show business.
Wow.
And Rick, when you and I started out, our parents were, when we had show business dreams.
Completely supportive?
Yeah. I mean, you speak for your family, Rick. You saw with my family. They stopped talking to me for 2 years. My dad didn't talk to me for 2 years because of my decision. And
no, I didn't have it that rough, Kev, to be honest. But not.
But you got the, when are you going to get a job with benefits, Rick? You got that. Yeah, but no, but I mean, but that's what we got. But I'm noticing the difference now. And I'm not shaming our parents. That's just, guys, it's just how it was. What I'm saying is, what I find today is I have parents who are like, rich or poor, like, yeah, you know, little one, he wants to be an actor. Yeah, this one wants to sing. Yeah, he wants to write. So I don't know, like, you know, maybe you can talk to him. And the support they're getting, and first couple of years out, they're financially taken care of. It's so for you guys, for Kelsey and Elaine, for you, that's why you're so horrified that when someone wants to take a road less travel and everyone's not on board to support it, it's horrifying to you. But we grew up in a world where it was, you know, go punch a clock or you get a degree and then put that degree to use and get a job with benefits or whatever. So you really were an oddball. And by the way, Rick, you remember our friends after a few drinks would start taking shots at you for doing things that were different. I mean, it was just a different world, which is why there's a term some professor, I want to give him credit for. He calls it presentism, where we are applying today's rules and values by things in history or things we see in the past. And it just doesn't add up. It was a different time back then. So for the Hermie back then, be like, no, you're an elf, get back to work. You know? So again, I'm not condoning it. I'm just making a statement. That's why it's horrifying for you to see, because you grew up in a world where it was like, I want to be a, you know, or whatever. I want to be a poet.
Can I just interject? And I didn't think of this until we were just discussing it now. But I think Hermie's timing on this quitting is a little bit off-putting. Like, not to defend the former elf, the foreman elf or elf boss. But, dude, it's like 2 weeks before Christmas, and that's when you want to become a dentist? Like, wait till Boxing Day. Your timing is horrible, dude. Like, we're trying to make quota.
Great point.
Yeah, right? Where's your two-week notice?
Right.
Again, empathy for... I'm back again, empty for ball self.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of people.
Kev, I have a thought too, speaking of empathy, but back to the idea of like your father, you know, and fathers of that generation, and also Donner, you know, with Rudolph. I think a degree of it is overprotectiveness. You know, you don't want your kid to be different just so that they are going to be okay in the group.
Thank you.
Because they know ruthless it is, right?
Great point.
You're right. Thank you for saying that, Rick. Because I'll always, even when I talk to kids getting in our business, I'll say, listen, the reason your parents aren't always going to give you the best advice is because the parental instinct is to keep you safe, not necessarily to see you happy.
Right.
Their first thing is for you to be safe. So, but that's not always the wise decision. That's a great point, Rick. Back to best friend Fireball and Rudolph at practice. We meet Comet, and this is from Mario Cantone. He's like, he's every like gym teacher from the 40s to the 1980s. He's every mean gym teacher that you all remember. I want to be your pal. You know? So of course everyone fails horribly, but you know, best friend Fireball goes, hey, now's your chance to go goof off, basically not pay attention, and go meet this doe, who we find out is Clarice. But their exchange, Rudolph and Clarice have this nice heartwarming exchange where she's like, you talk kind of funny, and he's like, no, I don't, or whatever. And she's like, don't get angry, I don't mind. And he's like, you don't? It's just a nice, very heartwarming. You see that she's her. She's like the Kelsey and Elaine. She's very representative of your generation. Her. Yeah. Comet, of course, blocks it, you know, but before Rudolph can get back in line, she tells him, he asked her to walk home, which I thought was very brave. And then she says, I think you're cute. And then the infamous, the iconic, I'm cute. And up he goes, and then he does it again. He flies even higher and, you know, magnificent. Stuns everyone, including Santa. Then he starts wrestling with Fireball, play wrestling, and unfortunately the nose is exposed. Fireball and Comet are stunned. Then everyone else jumps in and starts calling him names. Santa, to me, continues to get lower and lower in this. It's the worst. I wrote Santa is the worst. Donna, he tells the father, you should be ashamed of yourself. Now, by the way,
yeah,
if he said
how
that,
could you?
Yes, right. But if he said that and said, why would you cover it up? You should be ashamed as a dad. Let him be him. That's the Santa I wanted. But instead, you should be ashamed of yourself for even bringing him out in public. You know,
right, like, get him out of here.
Yeah. What a pity. Too bad. And he had a nice takeoff, too.
Right.
So then everyone wants to get back to practice. But Comet, no. From now on, Rudolph can't join in any reindeer games.
Well done, Kip.
But here's a little side note. Okay, I'm not going to take up for Comet right now. I'm going to take up for Comet's family, his surviving relatives. Think of this representation of Comet, right? You've got Dasher and Dancer and Donner and Blitz and Comet, right? Like, think of this representation of Comet, the Comet brand.
Right.
This is what people know of Comet the reindeer.
Right. That's why you don't see a lot of Comet out there, because except for the thing
Elaine,
to scour
write
the
this
bathtub.
Name down. Elaine, write this name down. Marty Singer. We're calling Marty Singer's office, and then we're going to connect with Comet's relatives, and we're going to go after Warner Brothers. They've got the rights for this. Yeah, we're going after Warner Brothers. Yeah, think about it. If you're the Comet, your memories, my memories of Comet are completely tarnished. Was this what Comet was like?
Yes.
See?
That's in a word, like? I mean, yes.
We don't know. Okay, well, so you're undermining my case, Rick.
I'm sorry. I have to. It's part of the society up there.
And again, you see this thing? Would you hire Comet? Would you to bring to your kids' Christmas party? All the work. Think of all the work he lost.
Hell
out on.
No.
See?
No.
Okay.
I'm not hiring any descendant of Comet.
Hey, and you brought up a good point in the notes about the reindeer actually being female, which I thought was really interesting.
Yeah, that was my science nerd coming out in me. So. Male reindeer research has shown that male reindeer actually drop their antlers after the mating season. So they usually drop in November, and female reindeers hold on to their antlers. The male drop it because their racks are so big and it would be a lot to carry around in the winter and it takes a lot of energy. And then the females use it to help defend their kids against like wolves. So the joke or the, you know, kind of funny story is we have all these male reindeer figures here and the females in this show are seen as kind of demure and kind of weaker. But the funny or the irony is all the reindeer on reindeer's Santa's sleigh are probably female because they still have a rack of antlers.
And like names like Vixen, which is a female fox, it stands to reason. Like, what was the famous poem, The Night Before Christmas?
Yeah.
Right? Where he named them for the first time. Maybe he thought they were female reindeer. And we just have always misinterpreted it.
Moving right along. So Clarice being amazing. By the way, a 15-year-old actress playing Clarice. Shout out to this young lady.
Amazing.
She says, it's a handsome nose. It's different. And that's what makes it so grand. By the way, wasn't it great when things were grand, Rick?
It was great. It was grand.
That's still 40s or 50s, really, even though this was shot in the 60s. I don't think people are saying, well, I think that's just grand. So, you know, the one of the things that's real big with the kids today is they'll say things are crisp. And if things aren't crisp, they're soggy. Hashtag crisp with a K. I think, can you also put this down, Kelsey, that we want? Let's bring back grand.
Okay.
Okay.
I could bring back grand.
There was grand and there was that's rich. Remember, that was another one.
That's
rich.
And even rich. not to get, you know, too down into the weeds, but gay. That you heard that all the time in its original context, right?
Right.
What a gay day it is. Yeah.
Yes.
Right. I don't know if that would fly, but I'm into rich and grand.
Right. I live in Florida, so it definitely wouldn't be
okay.
Right.
She sings There's Always Tomorrow, and again. No coincidence, she goes on to be an opera singer. And I have to say, manager Kev, the Captain Lou Albano manager me, like she would have had today, she would have recorded that single. That would have been a huge hit. She would have done a Christmas album. You know, she's a beautiful voice. It's a beautiful song, too. There's Always Tomorrow. Okay, then up comes Clarice's father. No doe of mine will be seen with a red-nosed reindeer. Now, by the way, you know what I'd like to think his backstory is?
I do want to know, Kev.
Well, you know it's true. He didn't make the team.
Right.
He never made Santa's team, so he's just an extra bit miserable. Jealous, miserable, you know what.
Yep.
Sorry, he buddy. You just not good enough.
Was he not named? They didn't name him?
I don't think he had a name, no. Mm. I think we had Comet and Donner. Now, if he has a name and you know that, please, you can hit us up at, and what is our text number?
Our text number is 351-251-2511. That text number again is 351-251-2511.
Nice. Okay. So if you know if this, great, if the father had a name and was part of the pack, fine. But until then, I think he's just miserable because he didn't make it. Sorry, your dreams didn't come true. Sorry, you didn't get a Rudolph or another boy to pull the sleigh. Sorry.
Right. So is he unemployed? Do we ask that here?
I think he's employed, factory worker, just miserable though. Just miserable. Yeah, he's doing something. But
working,
you know,
in the corn factory.
Something, but rather be grateful. Like, no, he's just jelly donuts, jelly beans, looking at everyone else. And focusing on what he didn't have. So anyway, I'm happy to talk to him when the time comes. Hey, Christmas Specials We Love podcast fans. That concludes part one of our coverage of Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer. Be sure to tune into part two, where we'll continue our very deep discussion of one of certainly the most popular, if not the first, Christmas specials produced of all time. Okay, we'll see you next time.